it seems, to have a dream to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I am your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. How are you today? I am fine. I am hot, but I am happy. So we have a really great show for you today, and that is why I'm so darn happy, because it's the first ever Rise Up podcast where I have two guests talking at the same time. Oh my goodness. Because last week I got to sit down and talk with Blair Marvin and Andrew Hain, the husband and wife team that make up Elmore Mountain Bread and New American Stone Mills. How cool is that? I met them both at the Taste for Grain conference back in Montreal in May, and it was spectacular to meet them. A little bit flattering too, because I've admired them from afar. I've met Andrew once before at Wheatstock, but I've admired both of them for years now. And when I met them in Montreal, the first thing they said to me is, "Hey, we were listening to your podcast on the drive up." And boy, did that make me feel good. So, of course, I had to reach out to them and I had to learn their story. And that's coming up in a few minutes here, because it's an interesting one with some twists and turns and a whole lot of goodness in it. But before then, how are you? I'm doing okay. Like I said, I'm still baking 2 more weeks before I take an extended break and perhaps a permanent one in this location, because as I mentioned last week, we're selling our house and moving out to the coast in October. And if the house takes a while to sell, that means I might be done baking here at the end of July, which is great. Really kind of exciting to be doing new things, and also extremely scary and very, very sad. It finally hit me on the weekend when I was serving customers out of the garage on Saturday, and a couple of folks that mean an awful lot to me said, "You know, I'm really going to miss you. Not miss the bread, but actually miss you." And that shook me up a little bit, because I'm going to miss them too. I'm going to miss everyone, even if it was just because they liked the bread. But new adventures, what you going to do? I seem to have to keep moving in my life, because I sat and did the same thing for a very, very long time, and I'm making up for it now and seem to be changing every couple of years or every 3 years. But that's okay. I'm still going to be podcasting. Someone sent me a note and said, I sure hope you keep podcasting. And yes, the podcast is going to happen. I have some other ideas for you guys, some other things that I'm working on, but I'm not going to announce them until they're actually ready to ship, which is still a couple of weeks away. So I'm actually baking 2 days this week, but early, because I'm busy on Saturday. So it's going to be, Thursday and Friday this week. And I've almost sold out already, because, people are starting to hoard a little bit and stock up, trying to keep some bread in their freezer for a little bit longer. So, there we go. That's it. That's all for me, this week. Everything else is just going, hunky dory, as we say. So, back to Blair and to Andrew. So if you follow Elmore Mountain Bread at all, you'll know that they make amazing bread, and they make it in a massive brick oven, and they use fresh milled flour, and they make their own mills, to mill the flour. And, I also learned a bit about, how they work with farmers to get the grain to put in the mill, to make the flour, to make their bread in their brick oven, which is extremely cool. So stick with me for the next hour as we head back out to Vermont. Just picture, if you will, Blair and Andrew sitting on their couch, looking at my ugly mug through the computer. Behind them is a glorious sunny summer day out on their acreage and bakery and mill manufacturing complex in rural Vermont. So just picture that, and we will drift off. And the next thing you will hear is me talking to Blair and Andrew. Looks like a beautiful day out there. What's it like these days in Vermont?
Hot
Is it hot? Do you get like big humidity and stuff too?
Not usually too bad, but
okay.
It was really, really rainy for the beginning for the last few weeks, and then now for like 5 or 6 days it's been good, which is really important for our farmers.
Yeah.
Everything, our season is so late, and just we really needed the dry, sunny weather. So it's
good. Okay. Well, because you're working straight with farmers and stuff to get the grain into the bakery and that, eh? So
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, start paying more attention to that as well, for sure. I know here we got a lot of we've had a lot of rain in the last couple of weeks, but before that it was super, super dry, to where they were sort of like, well, should we seed, shouldn't we seed, you know, because it's all like spring wheat and stuff. And and then they because I had read that they had actually extended the deadline to get your seed in for crop insurance up here. And okay. So to the 25th of June, which is pretty late.
But
then we got a ton of rain and everything's green and lovely. So we got the rain and the heat. So everything should just be growing, like where you can see it and stuff. So
Cool.
So, well, thanks for agreeing to do this. This is so cool to see both of you at once for one thing. This is really neat.
Yeah. I literally liked that you wanted to talk to both of us at the same time. I love that. And also we're both going to be traveling a bunch and gone. I was like, oh, well, let's just, we're both here and our son is away for the week. And so it's quiet. And I was like, all right, let's just do this, 'cause we're going to be gone for weeks and a lot of traveling.
Where are you guys off to?
He's going to Miami to work on a mill, and then to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then I'm going to the kneading conference up in Skowhegan, Maine. And so kind of all over the place.
So cool.
Trips, and hard to line the both of us up coming up here soon.
Oh man. Well,
great.
I'm very grateful. Yeah. Thanks. So this is cool. Like, because, I have no idea how you guys got to this point. So how are we going to start this? Like, so are you both from Vermont? I guess is this sort of like hometown for you guys?
For me, it is. I grew up here not in Elmore, but two towns away in Johnson. And my family still lives there and grew up here. I went to college out in the Northwest in Seattle and Bellingham, and culinary school out there.
Oh, okay.
But my family is all still here. And I met Andrew out in Seattle when I was doing a culinary school internship. And we came back here just for a winter with the idea, this is like 17 years ago, the idea of just coming back for a winter and then going back to Seattle. And one thing led to another, and, you know, fast forward all these years and we're still here. It's like the vacation that never ended. We ended up, I was working at a cafe locally, and there was a really, really small bread, wood-fired baking operation kind of in Elmore that I was buying baguettes from. He was making like 100 loaves of bread a week in a tiny little Alan Scott oven. And I was in one restaurant account. And one day he came in and asked me, he said, "Hey, do you know anybody that wants to buy a house, 10 acres and a wood-fired bakery?" I was like, I'll put the word out there, but I'd love to come see the bakery because I wanted to know I was curious where the bread was coming from and how it was made. And really didn't know much about baking bread. So I kind of used that as an excuse to come up and check it out. And we came and saw it and kind of hung out with him. And next thing we knew, we were like, we could do this. Like, maybe we want to get out of restaurants and learn how to bake bread. And we knew nothing, but, you know, suddenly we blinked and we had purchased the house and this little tiny bakery with an Alan Scott oven in it. And the rest is kind of history. And
oh man,
15 years now this year.
We agreed to buy the house and the bakery and everything. And he said, "Okay, we've got about 10 weeks till closing. You better learn how to bake." And so we had about 10 or 12 bakes to do. And he taught me how to mix, how to fire the oven, how to shape, how to do QuickBooks and everything.
Like a crash course.
Wow. Holy Dinah. And were you involved in food as well, Andrew?
Yeah, I was also working in restaurants as a chef and looking for a change, and this came and it seemed to be a good fit.
Yeah. Oh man. So the bakery's on the acreage where you live. Is that
the, it's about
so cool.
Half of our, it's about half of our house.
Yeah. As per, it's pretty typical to find the bakers with wood fired ovens in this scenario living very close to or next to the bakery, just because of the nature of wood fired baking. It's so much of a not just a job, but so much of a lifestyle as well, because of that extra added wood-fired element and kind of having to tend to the oven a bit more than you would a traditional deck oven.
Oh, so. I hear you. No, for sure. For sure. I know, like I'm going out to fire mine for tomorrow's bake right after we're talking today.
It's been, awesome.
Like, Friday morning. Got to get going.
Right now it's been going since six this morning, and we won't be wrapping up the firing until about 11 o'clock p.m. tonight.
Oh, do you? Okay.
So
I hope it's okay to geek out a little bit on that. So so how often are you baking then? Like, are you baking every day?
No. When we first started, we baked Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the beginning, and we did a farmer's market kind of as the bakery grew. 8 years ago, our son was born, and we kind of took a sabbatical from farmer's market and kind of ended up just staying with 3 days a week. And how many years ago was it now when we started New American Stone Mills, Andrew's side project? Over 5 years ago, in order to free him up from the bakery a bit to be able to build the stone mills. We went down to 2 days a week. So we just baked Tuesday and Friday. And the idea is that I can pretty much do the majority of the work. And we have one part-time employee, and she's wonderful. And we bake during the busier season. We bake about 1,200 loaves a week, 12 to 14.
Oh, wow. Holy moly. Yeah. So that's a pretty big oven then to get that fire rolling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Cause I built, what Alan called the artisan size, right? So the four feet across, 32 by 48 or something like that.
Okay.
And yeah, so it's like 16 loaves at a crack. And, so you fire all day Thursday for Friday's bake then?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a black oven. Well, when we first started or took over the bakery, it was an Alan Scott oven that we were baking out of. And
that was a 5x7.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
And we basically baked and fired it until it dissolved, it disintegrated, totally fell apart. And
when we took over the bakery, we wanted to kind of grow the business and make more bread. And so we really started to, push the limits of what we could do out of it.
Yeah.
But also, because we were totally new to it, we reached out to a lot of other wood-fired bakers, and a lot of other wood-fired bakers would come and visit us just to kind of learn how to use it better and learn about what other people were doing.
Yeah.
And I had some ideas on how I wanted to improve on the oven if we ever had to build another one. And one day we were baking and we heard this big thump. And a big cloud of dust came out from under the oven, and we looked underneath, and a giant chunk of the mass underneath the oven had just dropped away, and we could see the rebars exposed. And we thought, okay, now we better figure out if we're going to build a new oven or what we're going to do.
We knew that we loved wood-fired baking or baking in a wood-fired oven. And we knew that we wanted to continue that, but we also knew that we wanted to grow the business beyond what our capabilities were in that smaller Alan Scott oven. And so it was, what we wanted to do was to be able to have an oven that would allow us to kind of bridge that gap between super, super small mom and pop and a larger artisan bakery, and be able to turn it into a business that would support us. And also to be able to do it in a way that was more efficient, generate copious amounts of steam, because I always struggled getting a lot of steam in the Alan Scott oven, and I wanted a certain aesthetic with the breads. And we also wanted it to be easier on the baker. You know, loading, you know, for hours in and out with a peel is hard work. And so we wanted to be, we were like, how come we can't use or have a wood fired oven, but have the mechanical advantage of a loader,
right,
for the oven? And so we kind of wanted to combine those, all of those things into a new oven. And we found a mason here in Vermont who is willing to design this oven. He had built some Alan Scott ovens previously, but was game to kind of do this new project. And he no longer bakes or builds ovens, but he used to operate a business called Turtle Rock Masonry Heat. And he's built wood-fired ovens all over the country until he retired from that.
Right.
But so he built that, and it worked. We were able to bake way more bread, use the mechanical loader, so it was efficient, it was easy on the baker. We were able to generate tons of steam and all of these things that just kind of felt really good to us and made us feel like we were making better bread that way.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and having a wide entrance so that you could use the loader would help quite a bit as well.
Yeah, there's three doors to it.
Through a small space.
Yeah. I mean, the oven's monstrous. It's
the oven's 6 feet wide and 12 feet deep.
Oh my God.
And the mass is 9 inches thick on the dome.
Yeah.
10 inches in the hearth. And the main changes were we made the opening three doors wide that has some kind of flapper spring loaded doors for quick opening and closing. And then has an internal flue for a little bit better firing. Instead of pouring a big concrete cladding over the top, it's all reinforced with steel to buttress it.
Yep. Very cool. Mm-hmm. And how did you do the steam then?
The steam? We were inspired by the Yokis ovens where it's circular baking, so you're kind of always loading and unloading, and it's all through timing to generate using the bread that's in the oven to generate steam for the fresh row of bread that's heading in.
Gotcha. Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay. So you didn't like design an injector or anything like that?
No. It's all done through timing.
That's nice.
And the loader loads and unloads. So it's very quick. So the steam is contained with it. Kept
that's awesome.
Oven. Yeah.
That's awesome. Oh, way cool. Oh, thanks. Yeah. That's, I'm fascinated to hear about that kind of stuff. And even like firing sequences and that, because, you know, I've got my system that works for me, but I haven't had another wood-fired bakery owner come and see what I'm doing in my backyard, obviously, right? So
yeah,
you know, you figure out what works for you, and I'm sure there are many efficiencies I could gain because I end up doing more small fires for a couple of days to get it hot enough to bake on the weekend is my thing. So I'll burn for about 4 hours tonight, and then it'll absorb, because I only know what I know for my own oven, right? But
that's baking, and we're especially working with the wood fired oven is you kind of do what works for you within where you are and within your
living
situation, and
because it certainly seems with me that the mass is only going to absorb so much. It doesn't matter how much I burn. You know, it's only going to absorb so much so fast. And so I'm kind of doing it in stages to kind of get the heat in there. It's only going to go, for me anyways, it's only going to go up, you know, I don't know, 60 degrees in a day kind of a thing deep in, right? And so, so we found a small fire, a medium fire, and a big fire over 3 days will get me good for Friday. And then Saturday is really, really the good day. You know, we could have a small fire on Friday, and I'm like, you know, I can go for days, it seems. But that's really cool, and good, lucky you to have access to a mason to work on the project. That's what I love about, you know, really smaller bakeries and especially the wood fire ones is it's really solving a puzzle, if you will, right? Well, I've got this building, and how are we going to do this? You know, what do you think? And you know, find a guy and away you go.
And, you know, people are always like, oh, you know, we've been doing this for 15 years and how does it stay interesting? And basically every day is a new puzzle for me with running the oven, because you're working with all of these different variables. You know, we're really good at firing the oven consistently, and we have systems for having a super accurate start temperature and for cooling it super accurately, but still you're trying to take all of these different elements and time them so that we're walking out of the door on deliveries at noon so we can be home at a certain time and the restaurants have their bread at a certain time. And so you're trying to take this wild factor where you're working with the wood that came from the year before or last year, and it burns at different BTUs, and trying to harness all these things and have a super, super consistent system and timing and final product. And so it's that puzzle every day that, at least for me, keeps me completely engaged. And it's, I love that part of it. And that's just one of the many, many, you know, pieces to that puzzle. But it's,
I'm right with you.
Repetitive work too, you know, where you're shaping bread all day. And
But it's, I'm right with you. It's the kind of thing where you can't, like, the engagement is the word, right? Like, you can't take your, you can't be, you know, reading a book while the bread's rising or anything. You always got something going on. You got, you know, and, well, I'm sure you felt it where you get one piece of information too much in there, and it's all going to break in your head. But it's, anyways, I have my, you know, I can keep, you know, I'm going to say five things. I can keep five things going. And if I have to do a sixth, I'm in big trouble.
So, you know, beauty of systems.
Exactly. And I found the multi-timer on my phone is my friend now when I'm trying to keep six different bakes going at the same time. It's like, okay, something's binging. What am I supposed to be doing again? Cause I'm trying to focus on, you try and stay present, but you got a lot of balls in the air at the same time. So
yeah, absolutely.
No, that's awesome. Well, and you're, I guess to do the, when you scaled the oven up, what else has to change, you know, in your production then? Because did you also have to scale up in other areas? Like, are you, you know, like bigger mixers and more bench and that kind of thing? Or, you know, when you've got more bread that you can put in the oven, it seems like everything else has to go up as well.
Yeah. All the pieces have to fit together.
Yeah.
No, probably the one change was the time went down that we had to spend at the oven. Our space was pretty adequate, and mixer and
and our walk-in, it was
more just to keep up with the demand that we had built, you know, in the business we had built, but also get it done in a more reasonable time.
So, right on.
Yeah. Really trying to think about after, you know, many years of baking on the Alan Scott oven and kind of working in that fashion, we really were starting to think more about, in conjunction with this oven, about a work-life balance too, and trying to figure out how to sleep, which was really important. We hadn't been doing very much of that. And we had a baby, and that changed everything. And so there were all of these different things that kind of led us to trying to be more efficient with that.
And so how is it going now? I guess it's you said you had an 8-year-old and stuff, and you know, with the two of you and a little one and a part-time employee, how are you able to make it all go? Are you getting the sleep that you need these days? I'm trying to give some hope to some of the listeners. Look, it does get better.
No, it's really amazing. We have systems and the oven and the equipment that allows us to produce the amount of bread that we want to and need to, and be able to have that work-life balance. You know, our hours are very good. I just finished my mixing shift today. I was done at 3 p.m., which is very reasonable. So like during the school year, where I'm able to hang out with him when he gets off the bus, that sort of thing. We found that with everything, we kind of have this habit of things becoming really, really smooth. And then trying to look for something else to challenge ourselves in new ways. And so kind of as soon as things get really easy or timely, we throw a wrench in it and decide to go and do something, add something else to our, to what we're doing. And so we've kind of been growing in other directions in the last several years, but it all works really, really well. We kind of wait until everything is set and then we kind of say, all right, what's next? Do we grow the business? What do we do? Or once we kind of hit this smooth space with the oven, we were looking for the next thing to do also. And we knew that we didn't really want to grow the bakery, but we also suddenly had this baby that was starting to eat food, and we wanted to be able to, of course, like new parents or any parents, give them the best food we possibly could. Sure. Yeah. And so we tried, instead of thinking about growing the bakery and moving to a retail space, because we're just a wholesale bakery, or so opening a brick and mortar or kind of expanding our trajectory, we decided to look inward on our product more and what we were making and try and figure out how to make it better.
Right.
And, so then we kind of took all that nice smooth sailing and threw a wrench in it because we realized that we wanted to be working with local grain, and to be able to do that, we needed to be milling. And so we started to think about how to start milling all of our flour for the bakery on site here.
Yeah.
And so there are several of our same style of ovens built all over the place. And
by Turtle Rock. Yeah.
And one of the second ones that was built was Farm and Sparrow Bakery down in Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
And Dave Bauer built that oven with a friend, and we visited him and found that we had, you know, had a lot to learn from each other about how we use the oven and how we ran our businesses. And one of the things that he had always done was milled his own flour. And so I called him up one day and I said, hey, you know, how's it going? Really kind of interested in learning about milling and what kind of mill should we get? And he said, well, I have this Austrian mill and I like it for this, but I've been trying to figure out some new stuff. And what I really would like to do is build the same sort of horizontal mill, but with granite stones. I just haven't found the right person to build it yet. And so he knew that I had this interest in designing and building things from the oven work we did, and kind of baited me into it. Called him back a little while later and I said, yeah, I think I'm going to go for it. And so he connected me with a couple other friends who were interested in building mills, and we all sort of started researching it and figuring out how to go about building your own stone mill.
Right on. Yeah. Well, and I figured that you must be a pretty handy fellow then in terms of wanting to tinker and build and working with things other than dough, right? Because I've seen your mills before, and they're gorgeous. Like they're gorgeous, but it's like, I don't know. To me, that it's like, yes, you know, like a baker built this mill, right? Like it's beautiful, but it's also spare, and you can see the stones and that kind of thing. Whereas like the Austrian mills, they always look like a piece of furniture to me. You know, like, you know that there's something going on inside, but it's all just, it's all wood. And then there's a spout and flour comes out, right? Where it's like, yep, with yours, and I absolutely love it because it's sort of like, okay, I can, it's built to be adjusted and fixed or, you know, and the stone's redressed or whatever it happens to be. Cause it's all kind of there. It's like an old car that you can actually go in and do stuff to, as opposed to these new ones that are all closed in, you know? And I love that. Like, it's great.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We knew.
And so did you mill before you built your own, or was it just a case of I'm gonna mill, I guess I gotta build one?
Yeah, we figured if we wanted to make the investment, we would figure out how to build our own. So.
Yeah.
And we knew that we wanted to kind of, just the way we operate is like, we knew that we wanted to use all fresh milled flour is kind of like one of those go big or go home, like,
okay,
sort of scenarios. And so we wanted to be able to replace all of the roller milled flour that we were purchasing with fresh milled flour. And so we needed to design the machine in a way that would mill flour that would allow us to use 100% of it.
Right.
It was a, that was kind of how we went about,
how we approached it. Yep.
We wanted to be our customers to be able to, another big part was we had built this business over the years and this bakery and this great customer base with a certain style of bread. And we wanted them to be able to see the same bread that they'd been purchasing for years, but we wanted them to be like whenever they tasted it, I wanted to have that, the nuances of the grain and the impact of the flavor from fresh milled flour and the nutrition there, but be able to have them still see that nice, light, airy baguette.
And okay.
Yeah. That was kind of the challenge that Andrew had in front of him.
Yeah. So you're designing the mill and some sort of sifter right off the hop then? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we ended up for that first mill, I didn't know too much about how to cut the stones. And so we ordered some stones from Meadows Mills in North Carolina, and they cut some 36 inch diameter stones that were 6 inches thick. And I asked them to, plane them for horizontal, setup, and, also bought a sifter from that. And
okay.
So had the sifter, then I had to figure out how to build the machine and how to make it work.
Yeah.
I have a couple friends who, one's a good metal worker and another one who's an engineer, and we all kind of put our heads together, along with talking with some other baker friends, and kind of got it. Mine was the first one that we got put together and helped the other guys figure out theirs too, and then got it built and started milling. And you know, it was pretty rough at first, and we thought, okay, we'll start out, we'll mill 10% and then blend it in, and then went up to 30%. And I was doing the milling and I was also doing the mixing at the time.
Oh, okay.
Blair would always come in and shape with me, and then she would do all the baking. One day, she said, boy, this country dough, it's really different. What's going on?
Yeah. And he just had this like super, super hilarious, sly smile on his face. I was like, what did you do? He's like, I just went for it. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I just decided to go 100% with the fresh milled flour. I was like, oh my God, we're going to lose like 250 loaves of bread. This is going to be a disaster. And so fast forward 12 hours, bread is fermented overnight in the walk-in. We go to do the bake. We put the country bread in. And it was hands down the most beautiful loaves of bread we had ever made. And we were like, oh, okay. All right. This is very reassuring and very exciting. This actually worked. And then, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into, that we kind of from using small percentages for a little while, kind of learning about it. Like it ferments a lot faster. It absorbs a lot more water. It's much thirstier than, the flour that we had, that we had been using and were used to. But, we essentially just dove headfirst right into it. And we were like, okay, well, based on the flavor, of this loaf of bread, we can never go back.
Yeah.
and we just had to keep going and running with it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, did you get feedback from your customers when you went down that path, sort of saying, what did you put in it? Like that kind of
oh my gosh, this is one of my favorite things, because I grew up nearby, you know, I know so many people in the community, and I got this call from my hometown from this gentleman, and he'd been buying bread for years, and he left this very, very polite message, but he's like, I've been buying your country bread for years, I love it, but I have a complaint. And we're like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. So we continue listening to the message, and he was like, it tastes too much like wheat. And we were, oh, right. Thank you. You couldn't have paid us more of a compliment. And of course I called him back and I explained to him what we were doing and why the bread tastes different. And it was just a matter of explaining to him and letting him know and educating. And what that did for us is it realized that A, we were hitting our target of creating more flavorful bread, and B, that this was also an avenue to be able to open up the lines of communications with our customers that we hadn't been able to, like to be able to create a dialogue and to have an opportunity to say, hey, why is the bread different? Why does it taste like this? Well, it's because we're milling and because we're using this variety of wheat. And by the way, we're also buying the wheat directly from a farmer 20 miles down the road. And so this project, what we found out was not just about baking bread that we were happier with, as far as the flavor and nutrition, but it was basically a conduit for opening up all of these relationships, not just with the farmers that we were working with, and expanding our relationship with our primary ingredient in our bread, but it was also an opportunity to build a stronger relationship and increase communications with our customer base and to bring more education and awareness about wheat and where their flour comes from and why it tastes this way or why it doesn't taste this way. And so that was one of the most exciting things that have come out of that entire project is the realization that this isn't just about baking bread. It's about building relationships literally from the ground up. So
yeah, for sure. Well, it's you're taking what's a staple in a lot of people's eyes, you know, from the customer's point of view and making it something unique and very special and something worth talking about, you know, like the real thing. I get it to a lesser extent with some of my customers, because I'm not fresh milling, but even on a smaller scale that you're making something special, even though it's got a common name to it, you know, in terms of bread, right? And, you know,
yeah. Like,
where else are you going to have people, you know, drag their friends over, or when they have relatives coming, say you have to see this, you have to try this stuff. You know, it's really cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a great way to form connections with, you know, it's the most amazing way of connecting food and people.
Yeah. Well, and certainly with something that's such a commodity for so many people, right? Like that, it's just you don't even think about it. And here's now food where your customers can actually, you know, be thinking about the farmers that are growing their grain because they are their neighbors as well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's about changing the vernacular too. You know, people, whenever they go to the farmer's market or do their shopping, you know, talking about buying a commodity food, you know, people are very particular about their coffee and the way their coffee is made and how it's ground, right? And their dairy and your vegetables or brew, like beer and the varieties of hops, and everybody has this really heightened awareness of all of the different elements in so many of our foods, you know, the origin of the chocolate and that sort of thing. And so it always was surprising to me when people would grab a loaf of bread and they would be so particular about all of these things, but you know, not about the bread that they were eating, which is such a staple in the diet. And so it's pretty exciting to be able to kind of look at it through those same lenses and to create that same vernacular around the grains and around the way that the bread is being made from the beginning, and to bring that awareness to consumers and have them thinking about it the same way they think about all of these other things that they spend their money on weekly.
For sure. It's kind of like moving it to that category.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. And especially for something that is so widely consumed around the world, you know, and whether it's a flatbread or a sourdough bread or, you know, a pancake or whatever it is, that same conversation can be had.
Sure. And I would say it's not so much to make it precious by, you know, by or
totally,
really specialized,
totally,
but just to make it more understood, like why does this bread taste better? Or why is it better for you? Why is it better for, you know, the people in our community
or for our farmers or for the growing agricultural systems, you know?
Yeah. The better conversation. Yeah. No, that's a really good point, Andrew. It's like, you're still able to make it, you know, affordable for folks as well, right?
That has been important.
As opposed to, yeah, make the one of one. I'm only going to make one of this loaf and chart. Like, was it like, I think it was what, Wu-Tang Clan did that record that we're only making one.
Oh, yeah. Bring it up for auction in a gold box.
That's hilarious.
Totally. The 2019 loaf is now made. But that's so cool. So when we've talked a little bit about the customer reaction to the change that you made. What's it been like working more directly with farmers now, or in general? Like, that's how's that? What's that been like?
It's the best part of the job.
Yeah. Well, it was funny timing when we came into the milling, because we got the mill, got it working, and I said, okay, let's find some grain. And it happened to be a really bad year for grain in Vermont, and there's not a lot in Vermont, but also all over. And so the organic wheat prices went through the roof. And so we were kind of confronted with that challenge, and we were able to source the grain from some of the organic flour mills that we were buying flour from.
Right.
So we were able to start out that way. And then after that first season and kind of figuring stuff out, a friend of ours who has a wood-fired pizza business at the farmer's market said, hey, there's these dairy farmers who have a stand next to ours, and they're growing some grain. You should talk to them and see what they're going to do with it. So I went ahead and called them.
Totally. I just cold called them, which was absolutely terrifying to me. I was like, I know that you guys have your first year of grain. The variety was this winter wheat called Redeemer. It's actually, it's a Canadian. It's from Ontario. Yeah, it was from Ontario originally. But anyway, so they had put this Redeemer wheat into the ground, and kind of like, oh, so I've got this mill and this bakery, but no wheat. And you guys, what's your plan? And they're like, oh, we don't really know. But we had just purchased, we had the land, and we put it in. And it was one of the best conversations I ever had. And next thing I know, our families are getting together and having a barbecue and hanging out. And this sort of amazing relationship and friendship started right there, and partnership, because we were just getting into this milling project, and they were just getting their business off the ground. And so it became this really beautiful symbiotic relationship where we were able to co-brand. So like all of the breads that we made with the wheat from their farm in that first year's harvest, and ever since then, we put the story about that farm. We stamped their logo on our bags.
Oh, wow.
And cross promote and tell the story about where it's coming from and the proximity and what the variety is, and really try to educate our customers about the importance of this relationship.
Oh, that's
yeah, it was amazing. And you know, this year again, this is we're several years down the road of working with these guys. And what it did is also because the organic grain prices were so high at the time whenever this relationship was built, it kind of set a standard for us for what to pay them, and to realize that the value of paying them what they needed to be able to make it into a viable business. So because of us being willing to pay them a much, much higher rate than what the commodity organic grain prices were, they were able to build the infrastructure. Like, they needed a better dryer, so they built they bought a grain dryer, and then they were able to buy a bigger combine the next year. And so as we were psyched because we had all this beautiful local wheat to work with, and they were farming this grain and realizing that this was a viable business that they could actually make a living at and would be able to grow and get more equipment and to kind of have a solid business model. Sure. And so that was very, very exciting on both ends. And being through proving that over several years, we've been seeing more and more farmers in our area putting grains in the ground and being like, oh, we can actually get paid what we need to for these grains, make a living, have the infrastructure. And there's so many people and bakers and restaurants and pastry coffee shops that are interested in using local flour, that there's a market. And so this can actually be a viable business model. And so it's become pretty exciting to see the changes that have been happening here in our tiny little state that has it's largely agricultural, mostly dairy, but compared to the Midwest, our agricultural landscape is very small. There's a surprisingly large amount of grain being grown here now, and more every year. So
yeah. Oh, that's so great. Wow. It's so from a couple of things, just that this idea that you're not in competition with the people that you're buying from, right? Like, that it's sort of like, okay, we all have to make a living at this for this to work. Right. Like I remember, around the same time, when everything went crazy with grain prices, there was a story in our local paper. You know, one of the big bakeries here was bemoaning, about how the price of commodity flour went up to, $18 a bag or something like that. Right. And then, how can I do this? And it's like, I'm going to have to charge a quarter for the buns now or something. But it was like, well, for that to happen, a lot of farmers lost their crops, right? And the farmers were somebody that was driving my prices up, as opposed to someone where we're all in this together, And I just love the way that you described it. I love finding those types of relationships myself, right? Try to understand it, even with my friend Nicole that runs the mill that I get my flour from. Right? Very much interested in, how are things going and what does it look like this year? And it's not just because is it going to affect my prices? It's just, I need you, this flour, right? Or else I've got nothing. I'm going to the Safeway for my flour, I have absolutely nothing here, No, that's awesome. It's so neat how that comes up from a phone call that you dreaded.
Absolutely. And they're some of our favorite people, and it's been really, really neat to be able to work with them and to realize that what we're, every day many days a week, our focus is on baking bread, but it's also so much more than that now. That's been incredibly rewarding, and to be able to see how we can build these relationships here within our state. And now this year, for the first time since we started the project, like anything, it's very, very small, but we're almost entirely organic Vermont wheat purchased from the farmers. And that's kind of been our goal, and we're quite nearly there. And it's been a very, very, very exciting year because of that. We have five different farmers that we're working with, who are growing different varieties, spring wheat, winter wheat, rye, and different things around the state. And it's pretty amazing.
That's great. That's great. I can certainly second the benefits from a flavor point of view, just with fresh mill flour. I don't do it, but when I was out at Wheatstock last year, I was at Jim Williams' class when he was,
now lives in Vermont.
He's your neighbor now.
Very, very, very exciting. We are lucky to have him.
And I was just blown away. I went both from the class, and then I went to I went to Seven Stars at the time, and as he was baking stuff and tried some of the bread that he was doing. And it was mind blowing. It was like, just the different flavor notes that you're getting from the different varieties. It's so cool. I still think it takes a bit of a master's touch though, to get used to working with that fresh milled flour. Like it took you a bit to get going. Get it figured out.
It handles differently, but when it's milled nicely, when it's milled and to the kind of consistency that you're used to flour, you know, feeling like.
Right. Yeah.
It can handle very much the same. It'll definitely be thirstier with the, you know, some of the brand, more of the brand in there and the germ. Right. Usually is more active, because it just seems to be much more alive.
We just
experiment, you know, try this, make one change every time and made it work.
And do it in a very, very scientific and categorized way to be able to watch and document the changes that needed to be made. But it's just like, you know, working with a different lot of flour from a mill, or changing up your grain profiles and of any type of flour that you're putting in. It's part of being a baker is having that, that mix of science and art, where you have to have that analytical, look at it with that analytical view to be able to make the changes that you need to. One of the really nice things about working with the farms in the sense is that we have, so with like Nate and Jesse Rogers who grow the Redeemer, we have a whole year's harvest and we know the tonnage that we have from them. And so every season, every harvest, it gets tested by the University of Vermont. So we have the protein, we have the falling number, we have the moisture. We also have it tested for mycotoxins and food safety, all of those things. It's done through the university. But once we have those numbers and we test it and we kind of get a feel for how it's going to perform, we basically know that we have a year's worth of that wheat. And so pretty much we're able to set our formulas and rely on that consistency. Though, that being said, one of the coolest things at the same time is, you know, you get halfway, well, this is a couple of few years ago, got halfway through, I guess, what the harvest was. And I was mixing and we were mixing and all of a sudden the dough was just falling apart. We're like, oh gosh, what's going on? Blah, blah, blah. It just so happened that, Nate was coming up for a delivery that day. We said, man, we just totally lost this entire lot of bread. And he was like, oh, what sack was that from? And we're like, oh, it was this number on the bag, because we get that we received the wheat in 1-ton super sacks.
Oh.
And he was like, oh, I forgot to tell you that this is from the same harvest, same variety, but a different field across the way, across the road, and the drainage is different because the soil is different, and there's a river that runs right between it, and so all of those little not so little pieces of what makes that soil into, you know, the how the grain grows there and how it performs and the flavor, it was from a different field, and it acted and reacted totally differently in the mixing bowl. And as frustrating as it was to lose a day's mix, it was still just like, wow, that's amazing. Okay, so now we have to figure this out again. And that's part of what's most exciting for me as a baker, to be like, okay, we knew that it was still totally bakeable, but to be able to just have that opportunity and be like, oh yeah, it's going to be a little different, and this is why. It was very exciting. But generally speaking, we have that consistency and we can just rely on that. And as long as we know that it's being milled consistently and it's from the same year, we're good to go.
Oh, that's awesome.
So
cool. So Andrew, like, is the number of bakeries fresh milling, is that still on the rise? Or is that what you're finding, big demand for the mills?
Yeah, it seems to be.
Yeah.
After we had built our first one, a lot of the friends and bakers that would come to visit us to see our oven started coming around again and saying, oh, you know, what's up with your mills? And then they said, oh, would you, any chance you build one of those for me? And so
Jim Williams was one of the first people, actually, from Seven Stars.
Mm-hmm. And so I decided to make a go of it and started building a few for them. And then that was 2015. And now I'm just finishing up the 60th mill.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and getting calls and inquiries all the time, all over the world, actually.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny. At 2015, that's not all that long ago. Because I remember when when Jim, because Jim was asking questions at the Guild Forum because he had bought a mill and wasn't happy with how it was designed and then was working with you. I didn't know that that was the one of the first ones that you had built. That's really cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the other really exciting things about this project too, that happens to fall with the location of where we are here in northern Vermont, is Vermont has a huge historical tradition of the granite industry. And so we get to work with a local granite shed just 25 miles down the road. There's this place, this town called Barry, Vermont, and it's kind of a hub in for historic granite mining. And there's granite sheds still operational, and it's one of the largest parts of the industry in our area. And so we have this amazing granite mine called the Rock of Ages. It's extraordinary, and so all of the granite is cut from the Rock of Ages just down in Barrie, and working with these granite sheds. And they were really excited because they're like, man, we are so sick of making tombstones and granite countertops and steps. We're actually doing something that is functional, that has a root in history. And the guys with who work at the shed that we ended up working with love it. They come up here and nerd out and geek out with Andrew all the time, and are very excited to be able to see it being used in this sense. And so it's very neat too to have this resource of that, and thinking about the history and the identity of our state, and kind of combining it with the stone mill project. It's been really very, very cool.
Yeah. Holy God, you guys are going to be like seriously self-sufficient. That's you know, a good way, but it's like, cause I know the history of, you know, how, you know, the New England states were, you know, self-supporting until the Midwest got opened up, and then everything sort of left, you know, literally greener pastures and, you know, level land and stuff. But it's nice that just the knowing where you fit in the circle of life there, that says, you know, things that you do can reinvigorate other people, other industries, other families, right?
That's so cool. It's a really deepened sense of community.
Yeah.
I didn't realize growing up here, all I could think about was getting away. But now that I've been back and through all of this and understanding the impact that building these relationships and how you can operate within the community like this. And it's like to be able to work with these granite sheds and to be able to work with metal fabricators and a powder coater and all of these people, and the guys who cut the firewood for the bakery, like all of these people live within, you know, half an hour of us, and to be able to work within our immediate community and create these jobs and these relationships and be able to have that greater sense of community, I think is really important. And I feel its value a lot more nowadays than I used to. And I find a lot of comfort in it, I guess.
Yeah.
Through that.
Oh, for sure. Like it's just so neat because I think with a lot of the people that I've talked to on the show, it's a similar story, but different resources or different pieces of the puzzle, you know, depending on where you live. Right. You know, when I was talking to Joe Fitzmaurice in Ireland, it's a different situation there, granite wise, let's say. Right. But he's trying to do similar things out there, you know, and it's just so, so neat to hear this story because, I see it happening again and again and again around the world where, you know, bakers, just sort of how their position can go one step further in a certain direction and make that one more connection and bring it home to them, you know, into their community. That's neat. And it's just so neat to see someone like you two that have been at this for a while now. You know, you get 17 years in, right? You've got a lot more opportunity than folks that are just starting out, but it's just to see those tentacles kind of spreading and kind of gathering everyone together is amazing. I just think it's awesome. Yeah. So then how are you feeling now? Are you nice steady state? Are you ready for another leap, or is it just trying to get the milling business into the fold Is that the disruptive thing, or where are you guys at?
the mailing business is going steady. I work, most of my work is doing that now. Yeah. I do all the flour mailing for the bakery, and probably do 6 or 8 hours of production.
I won't let him out entirely. I'm like, you can go and run with this milling project and building the mills, but the whole foundation of what we built was working together. And we also decided, whenever we decided to really move forward with New American Stone Mills, we were thinking about moving it off premise and into a very convenient location. And what we ended up deciding to do was to build a shop here on our property next to the mill house, because we have a bit of land here. And also, again, about my favorite word apparently today is relationships, but being able to have the mills being built here, and then you walk through a door and there's the flour being literally milled right there, and then you walk down the driveway a bit through the dooryard and you get to the bakery, and there's the flour being mixed. And to be able to have those three pieces and connections together on site is really, really important to us, and to demonstrate how you can go from point A to point B to point C to these loaves of bread. And also, it's awesome because Andrew's here and he can get our kid off the school bus.
There you go.
Which is really nice too. And to continue, even though he's a ways up in another building, to still be working together and kind of holding on to the core of why we have been doing this all these years.
Yeah. You got to mention as well, like just that you guys have carved out a lifestyle that you can be there when your boy gets off the bus. Is that's not trivial. Like, that's an important thing, you know.
It's so, a big thing.
Like, really good for you guys. You know, my kids are older and they're all moving out and stuff now, right? But but this is it's important. It just is, and so the fact that you can do the things that you're doing and still maintain a lifestyle of you know, some joy is great, you know, because that's another.
Well, what's the point if not, right?
Exactly. Why are we doing all this work? Yeah. We can't do that. So no, that's fantastic, you know. And your son's 8 years old.
Yeah, he's going into third grade.
So you've got probably 5 years before he's kind of like ready to springboard off into the next venture for you guys, right? You know, he's going to need a piece of the business to run, you know?
Yeah. Well, man, the kid, if nothing else, he knows about bread and about milling. He's quite the little self-proclaimed authority. But it's all he knows. The day he was born, he's been in the bakery and in the mill shop and hanging around all of that.
Can be the tour guide for visitors to come.
That's awesome. And you know, and even you know, when he turns 13 and rejects all of this and goes and works in a bike shop or something.
Yeah.
That would be great though.
Yeah, exactly. But I was just gonna say, it's still in there, you know, because like when I had my bakery, my kids were in high school and they both worked, and my daughter worked in the back a bit because she didn't really like serving customers. And so she's got the baking shop. She was doing all the cookies and muffins and scones and that kind of stuff. And my son worked the front and was scared to death of touching the dough or anything like that. Didn't want to mess anything up. But it absorbed into him anyways, you know, because he's living in Vancouver now and he's sending me pictures of the bread that he's baking and this kind of a thing, right? And it's like, where did this come from? You know, and he said, well, you can't not absorb it a little bit. So that's awesome. It sounds great that he's into it, you know? So
yeah, absolutely.
Good deal. Yeah. Well, this has been just the most fun ever. I have to say, I'm so grateful to hear more about what you guys are up to and have been up to and the great things that you're doing. And it's just so nice to see a partnership like this blossom. Like that's fantastic.
Thanks.
So, thank you.
And we really appreciate you doing these interviews. It's a nice thing to listen to know that there's other bakers out there, who hear their stories and what they're up to as well.
Right.
Yeah,
on.
That's pretty rad.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's like I feel like even though we're all, you know, miles and miles apart, we're all kind of all in this together, and that's The stories that I'm hearing from folks certainly reinforce that in my mind. I think, yeah, you know, everyone's on the same path, maybe just at different points. So cool. Well, this has been great fun. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Cool. Well, thanks guys. This is going up like next week. So when you guys are on the road, it'll be like the Wednesday show. You'll have something to listen. You can listen to your voices and stuff.
Oh my gosh.
But no, I really, this is fantastic. And I've like, there's so much cool stuff going on in Vermont. I had no idea, you know, like other than, you know, the odd story, like I know Jeffrey lives in Vermont and King Arthur Flowers there, but in the last year since I've been doing the show, holy
yeah, there's
you guys.
Yep, there's a legacy here.
Yeah,
sounds
the food in the food world. It's Vermont's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah,
awesome.
Especially per capita, it's like the amount of like amazing breweries and cheesemakers and bakers and cutting edge farmers who are really kind of doing amazing things based on our landscape and how long our winters are. It's just that alone. It's the quality of the foodstuffs that are happening here is pretty extraordinary. Yeah. Very lucky. Cool. Very
well,
small.
Well, and certainly like, you know, from having not been to your place, but just seeing it on Instagram, it's like, you guys are really knocking it out too. So it's, that's awesome. I'm thrilled. I'm so glad we got to meet in Montreal too, because you know, because it's funny because it's you guys are right from the early sort of concept of the show. I always had in my mind you were two folks that I wanted to talk to, and then it turned out like you're so darn nice. So this is great.
Oh shucks.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, guys, and you know, get some rest. I think you got a busy day tomorrow, but
indeed.
But it's been great talking with you.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Take care. Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye. And that is Blair and Andrew. My goodness. You know, so many amazing things that they've done and they're already doing. But if you take one thing away from this chat, I hope you take that joy in Blair's voice when she talked about actually meeting the farmers and working with them and being part of their lives as people, not just as vendors and suppliers and that kind of thing. And how glorious that connection is. And in the same way, how they're, you know, reviving a local granite mill to make stones for their mills. Like, it's just so darn cool. And it just is, it's, you know, it's hard work and you know, it's risky work, but it's more than romantic. It's aspirational to have those kind of relationships with the people that you work with and to really know every link in the chain, in making this great bread that you're sharing with people. So I hope you got a lot of inspiration and some insights and some ideas from this chat. If you like the show, please reach out to me and let me know. I'd love to hear from you. You can just go to the website, riseuppod.com, and drop me a message there. If you want to leave me a rating and a review on iTunes or the Google Play Store or wherever you get your podcasts, that always helps because, you know, people see a podcast like this and they want to know if it's any good. So if you think it's good, tell people. That would be great. And until we meet again, I hope you just have a great week, a great week baking. Work hard, make good stuff, share it with everyone, and I'll see you next week with another chat. Happy baking.